tape here. Go ahead, Fred.
Well, there are several things that I should amplify, and perhaps the organization of the was now Torkentorp LLP was a very enjoyable experience. I mentioned that I had known Mo for a long time. And one of my early experiences with Mo when I was in the Hart firm, I represented Suburban Gas from Los California that came up, and I formed a little subsidiary for them to run the operation out, and they were buying. Well, Mo's client called him a call, who still didn't like that, so he had Mo bring an antitrust lawsuit against Suburban Gas and his people. And he found my name among the papers, so he named me as a defendant too. I called up Mo and said, "What in the hell are you doing? You know I don't have $2 million. What are you suing me for that?" I go, "My God, I'll name you, I'll dismiss right away." So he got me out of that lawsuit. And I remember also with Mo, I was working on a lease of some kind where he represented the other party. And I had a gal using Stephen's form to pick out paragraphs that were pretty well used in commercial leases. I didn't watch very carefully what she had done, and the draft that I sent Mo contained one of those self-serving paragraphs that Mo couldn't overlook. So he called me and said, "Hey, it's a pretty good lease, but you know, you come down with this paragraph that says he means she, and she means it, and it means them. I don't quite understand that. Who is she, and who's he?" I said, "Oh my God." I said, "Take that paragraph out, I'm not supposed to be in there." Well, I was very pleased that with the group that we started out with, which then measured as I've recited, Mo, myself, Maury Galen, Brian Booth, Ken Stevens, Terry Baker, Don Marmaduke, Mike Morgan, John Nickel, I think I've touched all the bases there. We're really a very compatible group and a hard-working group. And I'm very proud of the fact that my name is still associated with what I think is the best law firm in town.
Didn't you say when we started that firm that you were through with big law firms and you never wanted the new firm to have more than 15 lawyers?
That was a target that Mo and I agreed upon. The 15 lawyers was going to be the maximum number we'd have. I don't think that lasted very long.
I think we're about 50 more than that right now.
That's right now.
Have you noticed changes in the practice during the long period of time you've been involved in the law that you want to comment on?
There have been a lot of changes, and I think the most dramatic is that I started, all that I needed was a pencil and a yellow pad. I could hunt and peck on a typewriter. As we went along, the typewriters became electric, so I couldn't even start the darn things. I used to be able to make copies, but then the copy machine, you had to punch numbers in to get it to go, and I never could handle that thing. And the telephones became more complicated. To try to dial an 800 number was almost impossible. So mechanically, the law has really changed into an area of requiring technical abilities that I just don't have and have no desire to have. I had that in mind when last year, one of the times that I came to the office, the young lady sitting out there who was in charge of the computers said to me as I went by, "Mr. Torp, you're the only lawyer that doesn't have a computer in his office, and I have an extra one. I'd love to put it in your office." I said, "I don't want any computer. I would not use the thing." She said, "Well, how about your email?" I said, "Email? Nobody writes me at all anymore. I don't want any mail coming in." I thought it took her aback. Well, some of the things that this firm has accomplished, I think, are truly outstanding, with no credit to me. But we've had very able lawyers, and we've attracted some good clients. And I here around town, we have one of the best reputations of any firm for integrity, which is very important, I think.
When did you decide to quit the active practice?
Oh, I have always been aware of that one of the worst things a lawyer can do is to be concerned about turning over his good clients to lawyers that are younger than he is. So I decided when I was 70 years of age that I would start scaling back. I think by the time I reached 75, I had already transferred all of my clients to some other lawyer. And somewhere in the last probably 7 or 8 years of my practice, I determined to transfer to what's called inactive status, so that I am still a member of the Oregon Bar, but I am prohibited from performing any legal services or expressing opinions, which is very delightful as far as I'm concerned. I have always referred to somebody else. But the best thing is that if you're inactive, you have no malpractice insurance to worry about. You have no bar dues to pay anymore.
No CLE.
No CLE. So it's not a bad life at all.
Well, when you were always known as someone who, a lawyer who was at the office very early every day, who took a quick lunch, who was in on Saturday, many Sundays. So what do you do with that extra time? What have you done in recent years?
Well, you know, it's delightful to have extra time. I've done a lot more reading than I'd ever done in earlier years. I very happily found a wonderful woman who I married in 1978, after having been a widower for about 7 years. And we've now been married more than 20 years, so it's something that I'm very happy with, and I think she is well received among my partners and associates. I think I'm very proud of what I've accomplished there. Now we go to the Palm Desert every winter for 3 or 4 months. This year it'll be 4 months, the month of November, then we'll go back down for January, February, and March. We've done that for 19 years or so, so we have lots of friends in that area, and our winters are very pleasant. And getting out of this rain country has got a lot to be said for it. And we come back, in April, at which time, where the weather's a lot better. I might say that one of my accomplishments back in my Hart's Venture days was to fill what I hadn't realized was a great desire to own a ranch of some kind. So I bought some property, 64 acres, out near Sherwood, which had an old barn, kind of a house, and I spent a lot of time on weekends painting up the house and making it reasonably livable, putting on a porch and putting screening on it. And all of this, I had a neighbor out there who was a truck driver, but very much of a handyman, so he did all the things like putting up roofing on the barn, the house, and putting a deck in. I didn't pay him very much, but he thoroughly enjoyed doing it. And I bought horses so my kids could ride. I never spent more than $250 for a horse, for which I got a good quarter horse too. The best bargain I had, I bought an old mare for $75. Looked very fat. I didn't realize she was pregnant, but she dropped a very beautiful little filly, which I had the satisfaction of breaking to ride. A city boy, I thought I had quite an accomplishment there. Well, I think I paid $10,000 for that ranch property. I think PGE wanted to put a line across the back corner. I think they paid me $7,000 for the easement. I still had the property. Then I realized that I suddenly had 12 horses out there. Two of them were my neighbors. And all of my children were long gone. And I had no longer had a wife. And it just wasn't much fun just going out there to feed those silly animals, so I decided to get rid of them and sell the place. The property next door belonged to Oregon Sand and Gravel. It was a gravel operation. tremendous ledge of rock. And my ranch was primarily rock covered by a few inches of soil. So we jockeyed around on it, and I sold that for a very good price. I was hoping they would renege on the contract, but they never did.
It was always interesting. You would hold annual events for the firm at your ranch, and
that's right.
Those of you who worked with you know you as a conservative lawyer in dark suits and white
right.
shirts, and we'd go out there, and you'd have a 10-gallon hat and cowboy boots and
jeans.
It was a whole different side of Fred Tour.
Well, it was a good experience, and it was. I thought that my daughter, who when I first bought the ranch was about 14 or 15, might become fascinated with horses, and she'd love it. And my sons were considerably younger, but my daughter loved horses for a year. And then boys came along, so. She lost interest in horses, but my two sons became very excellent riders and had their friends out there. They used to have their class parties out there, which always got the neighbors excited because they'd have music turned up to about 3,000 decibels.
You might mention where your children are now.
Oh, yes, I shouldn't forget my family. My daughter lives in Vancouver, Washington. She has been a school teacher in the Oregon system for many years, and she is now retired and fully vested with her pension, but she's still doing substitute teaching. She's married to a very fine man named Don O'Rourke, and they have a very nice house in Vancouver. So I see quite a lot of her. My oldest son lives in Santa Cruz, California. After hopping around pillar to post, he decided to get himself credentials to be a teacher, and he's now teaching in a high school down there. And I think the credit for that belongs to a lovely girl he married, Marilyn, who was a language teacher in the school system in Santa Cruz, and convinced him to take up teaching. And he's a very good teacher. He's teaching English literature, and he's very well thought of. My youngest son, my oldest son, by the way, has a very lovely daughter who's now 15 years old. She's quite a horse person. She's riding expensive horses and jumping, and it's sort of hard on the parents lugging her around, towing a horse around, but they're putting up with it. My youngest son lives in now in Santa Monica, California, and he about 3 years ago married a very lovely young girl named Mimi. They are expecting their first child, I think, sometime next month or two. So my wife Nancy has a son who's a lawyer in Seattle, Washington. Her daughter lives in Portland. So between the two of us, we cover the Pacific Coast states pretty well.
Now, you weren't always practicing law all the time, and during your days in Portland, you might mention some of your activities. I know you were president of clubs and involved in various nonprofits.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly true. When I lived in Lake Oswego, I was on the school board for about 12 years. And I was on the board when we put together the Lake Grove and the Oswego schools into a single district, which it now is. And that was a very enjoyable experience. I did a lot of work in nonprofits in Portland. The first one probably was what was then called the Community Child Guidance Clinic.
Now called the Morrison
yeah,
Child
Family
Clinic.
We hired Carl Morrison.
Yeah.
That's our first, yeah.
Right.
And then I think it's probably not a single organization that I was affiliated with somewhere, but in the course of that, I became a trustee of Good Samaritan Hospital, being a good Episcopalian. And I stayed with that for quite a few years, and I organized the Good Samaritan Foundation, which is now well endowed and helping the hospital. It was a strange situation because at that time Good Samaritan was sponsored by the Episcopal Church. It had actually been established by Bishop Morrison. Well, so the Bishop of Oregon was always the chairman of the board of the hospital. And Benjamin Dagwell was the first one I started with. And it was then decided by the board that we had to get a new director or a manager, because the one we had was completely unprepared for the responsibilities and not liked by either patients or doctors. So we proceeded to have a search committee, which came up with Jeff Stocks in Dallas, and so we hired him. But the bishop should have fired Frank Waters, but he said to me, "Tor, you fire Waters." I have the unpleasant duty of telling Frank to get his hat and go. I thought it was really a dirty trick. In the course of my duties in Episcopalian, I was also a chairman of the mission committee. We started a little church in Oswego called Christ Church as a mission, which is where you start. As a mission, the bishop assigns the pastors, and again, Ben Dagwell used the mission as a place to send all of his problems. So I had to worry about young men who were either chasing women all the time and had no repressions at all, some who were kleptomaniacs, so they had to bail out when they started stealing things. And finally, the one that really kept it was a young man who had suicidal tendencies. He told me he was going to hang himself to escape all the troubles of the world. So I told Dagwell, "Let's get rid of this young man because he's really a problem." I told him. He said, "Oh, he's just kidding. Well, the young man went down to the bishop's close and slung a rope over the upper balcony, put it around his neck, and so Dagwell didn't believe we had to get rid of that guy. Well, the mission then became a parish and it elected its own rector, so the problem was a little different.
You were on the State Board of Health too, weren't you, as a part
of that time I was on the State Board of Health when Tom McCall was governor. He appointed me. Okay, I knew Tom quite well. And that board no longer exists, but it was interesting. I think our basic problem was having the responsibility for overseeing additions to cities to make certain that the area that was being added was going to be able to handle its own sewage. And that was, you got in the middle of that kind of a fight around Eugene, for instance, oh, your God, nobody liked this. And I joined the Arlington Club in 1958. And I was president of the Arlington Club in 1972. I've had more than 35 years of membership, so now I'm still a member, but I no longer pay any dues, so that one I like. I belong to the University Club too for years, and that's, I still do, primarily because I have a pretty good library, and Nancy and I use it a lot. And I belong to Waverly Country Club. Again, I play such poor golf, it is a bad investment, but it's very pleasant. For instance, we had our office party out there where we stayed at the Waverly Club and avoided driving at night. So I've done a pretty good section of Portland, Oregon, as far as good causes are concerned. And oh, I've been on the nominating committee of the symphony for a while, and worked with Norm Layden and some of his contract problems.
Didn't you head the symphony for a while?
No. Jim Rogers did that.
Yeah, you were very active there.
No, I avoided that one. I think I also had some kind of a title with the old Portland Opera Company that Ed McCullough and Peter Curler's grandfather were instrumental in, that's right. And that was called the Portland Opera Company, but it consisted of men who liked opera, who had funds. They could put together a kitty to bring the San Francisco Opera Company up here for a couple of performances, which are always very interesting. But the fee charged by San Francisco grew proportionately in the same way that the amount of available funds shrunk. So that didn't last very long. And I think when the Fresno Opera Company was formed, what was left in the treasury was turned over to them.
Turned over to them, yeah.
Well, when you were at Hart Rockwood, I know when I was a young lawyer there, it was widely thought the group of lawyers were there may have been the most distinguished, capable group of lawyers to ever practice law in Portland. Yourself, Tom Stoll, Paul Bolway, you know the names.
Yeah.
You want to comment on any of those lawyers who were your colleagues so long?
Well, I certainly would agree with the evaluation of Tom Stoll and Paul Bolway as being top flight men and technicians in the law. Paul is responsible for Fred Meyer being fined in that office. Tom was responsible for the Collins family and Collins Pine. And Manly Strayer,
Manly
the litigator, he was one of the greatest men I've ever known, and even though he was known among the bar as being a singer of cowboy songs, playing on the guitar. I think the favorite story of Manly trying cases, I often think of, was one that Manly had. He was defending the Goodyear Balloon Company because they had sold a balloon for balloon logging down somewhere in Southern Oregon. And they took it up on a day when the wind was much too strong and the balloon came crashing down, so the log company refused to pay for it. Well, the witnesses for the plaintiff, who sued Goodyear for damages and so forth, were trying to establish that the wind that day was very normal. The trees were not whipping around. And they only had one man who had actually been on the scene, and he was an old-timer, so he told the story of how he looked across the river and the trees weren't whipping around, very little breeze out there. And he could see that across the river and the trees, and he could really detect that it was a very normal weather day. And then they just had one question for him. He said, "Do you have a nickname?" "Yes, I have." "What is your nickname?" "My nickname is Weak Eyes." Wow, I thought you just had to have it. I thought it solved that case.
Hugh Biggs was another great litigator in that, group, wasn't
he?
An old friend of yours.
Yeah, Hugh right now I see occasionally, but he has no idea who he is or who anybody else is, sort of a shame. But Hugh's most wonderful story, which he hated to have told, and I'd love to tell. Before he came to Portland, he was an assistant district attorney in Baker County. And in Baker County, he tried a case of arson. And various witnesses were talking about the fire, and Hugh, in front of the jury, said to one of the witnesses, "And where were you when the star farted?" That brought the whole court out to
One of the great lawyers in that firm was Omar Spencer. He was practicing in his glory when you were there.
Oh, yeah, I knew Omar quite well. And one of my favorite stories, if I could digress to talk about Oregon, I remember I went to Salem with Omar at one time. And he was driving, and he brought along with him a neighbor of his from Selby Island who got off and we got to north of Salem. And I said to Omar, "Who was that man?" He said, "To be very pleasant." He said, "Well, he's a farmer in Selby's Island, and I've known him for years. He came out here from West Virginia with a young girl that he married back there, so he said, and they raised a family on Selby Island. And she got religion. Then she began to worry about God, worrying about the fact that they left West Virginia because he had been chastised by one of the teachers and he took a shovel and hit him in the head and killed him. So he and his young girl came out to Oregon, and they've been very good at it ever since. They've had several sons, two in the military. But she kept working on it, and said, 'My God, you gotta make amends back in West Virginia for what you did years ago.' And she said, 'Oh God, now we're finally to make her happy, why, he talked to Omar about it.' And Omar said, 'Oh God, you want me to try to find out why? I'll get Kell a lawyer back there and find out. So he looked up in Martindale and got a good lawyer, talked to him, told him what the problem was, and he said, well, you know, I should tell you now that if he's going to be tried, I'm going to be the judge that tries him. I can't answer your question very well. Backed up and got another lawyer. And finally, they got through to the sheriff, whose duty it was to pick this man up. And the sheriff told Omar, well, I don't have any funds to send anybody out to get him, so if he's going to come back here to be tried, well, he better come back by himself. So Omar explained to the man that if he wanted to go back, he had to go back at his own expense. And his wife said, you got to do it. So he got on the train and went by train from Portland all the way to West Virginia. And I could just imagine telling the old ladies on the train he's going back to stand trial for murder. But that's what he had to do. Well, he got back there, and though he was indicted, since he was confessing to it, then they tried to find witnesses. And nobody had been in that churchyard, schoolyard at all, apparently, but the three of them. You know, nobody could testify to the fact that it was such an occurrence. And so the judge finally said, well, hell, he says, I'm not going to let you plead to this at all. He said, I'm going to release you on probation, and you report to Mr. Spencer back there and have him write me a report every 3 months as to how you're doing. And so he got back on the train, came back to Oregon. And Omar followed through, and he sent the judge a report every 3 months. Finally, after a year of it, the judge dropped him by a little note saying, "This is a very interesting report, but don't send me any more." But what had happened was, this man's wife had really gone off the rocker, and she was in the insane asylum in Salem. And he went down at least once a month to sit with her and talk to her. She didn't know who he was. But he was very conscientiously following through, being nice to his wife that had gotten him all this trouble. And that was a kind of a story you'd only hear from Omar Spencer in Oregon. Yeah.
A moving force in that firm in those days was also David Lloyd Davies, who sort of ran the firm from an administrative standpoint. And
he
headed up the U.S. bank account.
That's right. Well, David Lloyd Davies, and I didn't know it was see eye to eye, and he felt a personal offense that I decided to leave that firm,
right,
even though he was instrumental in getting me booted out. And his wife, Barbara, who survived him while he died, had the same notion that I was a traitor because I had abandoned that firm. But Lloyd was a hail fellow, well met. He was well thought of around town. He could talk at Blue Streak all the time. Ed McCullough, who I went to work for, was truly a gentleman. And he became interested in Willamette University, being a good Methodist. The chairman of the board down there, and I used to come down within the meetings of the endowment committee.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pleased that they have a football stadium, which is named McCullough Stadium, named for Ed McCullough. Mr. Hart was truly a dignified man. They had offices in the Yon building,
right?
So we had an earthquake, and the whole building started to tremble, the light fixtures swung back and forth. We all rushed down the hall to Mr. Hart's office, so Daddy would take care of us.
Yeah, those are beautiful offices of mahogany wood. And they had spittoons in each office.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And they had little washrooms in each office.
Sinks.
Little sinks with drinking water.
That was the old good old days, John.
And even when I got there, I assumed this was the rule. You had to wear a hat every time you went outside.
Now we had an office manager named Mrs. Potter, who laid down the rules for conduct for all the lawyers. And she just couldn't be repressed. Omar Spencer kept a little bottle of booze at his desk. And she found out about it. He went in when he was sitting there. She pulled it out, flushed it down the sink, and threw it away. Even the senior partner.
Senior partner. His name was on the door.
That's right.
And one thing about that law firm, when I joined it, there were probably the 35th lawyer, so there were no women. and no women lawyers.
That's right. Yeah.
And you and I were somewhat instrumental in getting the first woman hired, Velma Jeremiah. You might.
That's right. She had been secretary to Harold Miller, my good client.
Right.
Very well, very capable woman. I guess she became a partner after a while.
She went to Knight Law School and applied for a job, and there were many people in, whose names I won't mention vowed there'd never be a woman there as long as they lived, and we were able to accomplish that. She became an associate.
Well, she was quite a woman. She was president of the student body at law school, even though it's a Knight student.
Mm-hmm.
And she handled herself well. We've had good fortune, I think, of the lady lawyers we've had in this office. Several we lost for usual or unusual reasons, but the ones that stay with us, I think, are very top flight and well thought of.
Well, you said in 1945 you decided that Portland would be the place for you, and I assume you continue to enjoy Portland, except in the winters. And you've seen a lot of changes, obviously. But
I certainly have, and I think for the most part the changes have been for the better. Like every place else in the world, the amount of automobile traffic just increases. It's strangling the city all the time. Our transit mall, I think, is very effective and a good way to use downtown streets. Portland is, now the city is overwhelmed by cultural events. There are people around that are interested in the music and the arts. Excellent museum. I was on the board of the Historical Society for a while, and I was the president of the Historical Society for years. So.
Right.
And that's a good organization. Had a few problems that all the others have. No, I think Portland's a top flight city to live in, and I'm very happy that I'm here. I'm even happier in the winter when I'm not here.
Another activity of yours, as I recall, is a bridge. Did that come about because of Oswald Jacoby in your class? Don't you play lots of bridge over the years, haven't you?
Oh, yeah.
Been a bridge player?
Well, no, I don't. I think that quite probably when I was teaching in a naval training school, I had no idea who Oswald Jacoby was.
Okay.
But since that time, we've taken up a lot of bridge, and we play a lot in the desert, take lessons down there, so that's it. Very rewarding experience. I thoroughly enjoy bridge. Again, like so many things, I'm not the best of the world, but I have fun.
Well, anything else you'd like to comment on? I've never seen you sit this still this long before. I want to thank you.
Well,
thank you for doing it.
Yeah, that's right. No. Well, over the years, I tried quite a few cases in the federal court. Right? Gus Solomon. I knew Gus very well. And one case that I tried, he held in my favor, the tax case, rather complicated. And I went to the Court of Appeals here, and he was reversed with a very scathing opinion, saying, God, I didn't know he was doing it. I was embarrassed. And then 2 months later, a similar case came up in the Circuit Court out of Florida, exactly the same facts, where the judge reached the same opinion that Gus had. Mm-hmm. He was affirmed. So I told him, I said, see, Gus, you're just in the wrong circuit. That's all. James Alger Fee, I do quite well.
He wrote long opinions.
Yeah.
Like Gus.
That's right, yeah. Actually, when I first came to Oregon with Hartford, and we were getting into a lot of cases arising under the Office of Price Administration, which had regulations and lawyers that were looking for people violating it. So we had a lot of cases building up over there where clients were being sued by the OPA. Nobody had any idea what that was all about, and I didn't. So they said, wait, why don't you take these to them? You learn what it's all about. Well, I got to do it. And the fact was that most of the regulations were completely meaningless in the commercial sense. But I learned early on that all these cases are being tried by Claude McCullough. At that time, he had arthritis very badly. Very sharp lawyer, but he hated the federal government. every inch of his body. So all I had to do in these cases was to put on the government put on his case, and I moved to dismiss and granted. I think I won 38 of those cases. I didn't even know what that was all about.
Well, there was a case that was lost for one of your clients, Northwest Acceptance, down in Eugene, wasn't it? A jury case, and you didn't try it, I don't think, but that led to the rule about drinking. You might comment on that, on that.
Yeah, this was a case where the client was a corporation owned by my good friend Louis Cordovanch, and we had actually it was tried here in Portland.
Was it Portland?
It was Eugene. She had written that Eugene repossessing a truck which hadn't been paid for. And so we went in, it was pretty good. The wife of the purchaser was crying tears on the stand about her great big red baby that was taken away from her. So looking at the fact that it was 6 months delinquent payments. So Louis and I went to the Arlington Club and decided we'd have a drink for lunch when the jury was out. So we did have a cocktail and lunch. And told the jury was coming in, so we went back to the courthouse. My God, the jury held against us and awarded $35,000 in punitive damages, which in those days was impossible to live with. So we had to take it to the Supreme Court, which reversed it. But that led to the rule in my life, at least, and Louis also, that never on a business day were we going to have a drink at lunch because it would be bad apple that way.
And that's a rule that you adopted for the firm,
Tonkentorp,
that you don't drink, or if you do drink during the day, you don't go back to the office. Which
that's right.
Set us apart one time from lots of law firms where lawyers tended to drink it.
I think that's probably enough, Brian. Nothing else that I can think of as any consequence.
Well, thank you very much, Fred, and let me just say what a pleasure it's been to have this discussion with you, and I wish you well in the leaving this rainy, cold weather and having 4 months in the desert. Hope you have a very happy New Year.
Hope you come down and visit us.
Well, I might take you out.
Thanks
a lot.
Thank you.